Welcome to A Christian and a Buddhist Walk Into a Bar. My name is Jamal and I'm a Buddhist, and I think it's your serve, Jacob.
Correct. I return by saying that I am Jacob and I am a Christian.
Very good. You know, you're a sports fan.
Sure.
AFL, soccer, cricket.
Not so much the rugby.
Not so much the rugby. Okay, fair enough. What is it about rugby you don't like, other than like going to Las Vegas and, you know?
Well, I'm obviously a huge fan, as listeners will know, of going to Las Vegas. That's totally my jam. I think it's just the historical update.
The Barassi
historical
line.
Accident that exactly. I grew up south of the Barassi line.
Yeah.
And that is that.
Yeah,
there
okay,
we go.
Fair
and
enough.
Here we are today.
Did you watch the? This is going to date this podcast recording. Did you watch the recent New Zealand Australia?
Didn't watch because I refused to give Mr. Murdoch too much of my money.
Fair enough.
Listened to, and it was an exciting finale to the cricket. Yeah, all of this has spoilt my opening question that I had
prepared
and ready to serve at you, Jerome.
Rewind.
Go on.
My name's Jamal and I'm a Buddhist.
and Jamal, do you think that Roger Federer is a Buddha?
Ooh, do I think Roger Federer is a Buddha? So my first instinct is no.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think being very, very good at something makes you a Buddha. I think that Buddha might be more importantly about spiritual enlightenment and about, that kind of thing. I think anybody who plays professional tennis, no matter how well and calmly they do so, is at least somewhat attached to the results of a professional tennis match, and so probably is not a Buddha.
I mean, you could argue that anyone who's a senior monk is probably attached to some extent to the success of their monastic community and would find it harder to be a Buddha.
Roger Federer might be a Bodhisattva.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure he's a Buddha.
Yeah, fair enough. But not quite.
Yeah.
Because our jumping off point today is an article from 2006 from David Foster Wallace.
Friend of the pod.
Correct. Entitled Roger Federer as Religious Experience.
Okay.
So really the guts of the article are in the title. It's a wonderful article. He's a wonderful writer. You should read it. But is there something spiritual about sport? Is there a spiritual dimension to it? And certainly the grace, can we say, with which Roger Federer plays tennis or played tennis. Is there a spiritual aspect to that?
I think there can be a spiritual aspect to everything. You know, I personally find God in the sunsets. I think there's...
Has he found you yet, though, you're wrong? That's the real question.
Not sure. He's still looking. You know, I'm hiding. I can see the point, right? I can see the point that, like, and maybe this goes back to some of the other things we've spoken about where, you know, wonder is deeply spiritual.
Yeah.
You know, the concept of awe. Right, yeah. Awe and
well,
wonder.
And if anything in the sporting world is awe-inspiring, Roger Federer, I think, falls into that category.
Absolutely right, yeah. And I think there's a there is a spirituality to things that are awesome and awe-inspiring. And I think absolutely feats of sporting prowess can be. I mean, I think they're somewhat limited in that they're highly contextual, right? So, you know, that Roger Federer is only awe-inspiring in the context of the game of tennis existing in its very structured way. But yeah, absolutely. I think there can be, you know, lots of things can bring you to spiritual rapture. I mean, music can do it, you know, certainly. You know, art can do it, certainly. I don't see why sport can't.
And the Foster Wallace writes here that there's three kinds of valid explanation for Federer's ascendancy. One kind involves mystery and metaphysics and is, I think, closest to the real truth. The others are more technical and make for better journalism.
Okay, so what are the three explanations?
Honestly, he doesn't. He then goes into the metaphysical explanation, but doesn't then clearly tell you what the other two technical explanations are. Possibly it's extreme top spin. And is there another heading down here on the page? No.
No. Lots of topspin is option A. And so what is the metaphysical option then?
So the metaphysical explanation is that Roger Federer is one of those rare preternatural athletes who appear to be exempt, at least in part, from certain physical laws. Good analogues here include Michael Jordan, who could not only jump inhumanly high, but actually hang there a beat or two longer than gravity allows.
Yeah.
And Muhammad Ali, who really could float across a canvas and land two or three jabs in the clock time required for one. There are probably a half a dozen other examples since 1960. I think Lionel Messi probably falls into this category, seeing as if we're alienating all our Rafael Nadal fans, let's also alienate the Cristiano Ronaldo fans.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually, the Messi-Ronaldo, because he talks a bit about the Nadal-Federer thing here, and the Messi-Ronaldo analog is probably a fair one as well, because it seems like Ronaldo has made his career more around like just the brute force and the extreme physical fitness and everything else that he has, which is not to say Messi doesn't have that, but he also just has a lightness of touch and a kind of magic about him. And I think the Nadal-Federer comparison is a fair one there, where Nadal is this extreme athlete with brute force, and Federer is not, like, he's still an extreme athlete, but he also has a finesse and light about him.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was almost going to make the comparison between Federer-Djokovic maybe as a more kind of direct example of that, for me at least. I feel like maybe growing up a smidgen of years later where you know, I was aware of the tennis world, like, once Federer was already, the name.
Mm.
I think Nadal has always had a different kind of approach. I've never seen Nadal as that brute physical force kind of thing.
Oh, okay, interesting.
But
yeah.
But
Or just physical endurance.
Right.
Like, which Djokovic also has in spades. Yes. Yeah.
But I think all of it begs the question for me, though, which is the core question, is what makes some sports people have that factor which appears almost spiritual and some with equal levels of success not? Right, like, by the numbers, Nadal and Djokovic are better than Federer, right? Like, they are more successful in a
which time was that unimaginable was in 2006. Yeah. To be fair,
yes, yep. True. But yeah, so it's like, the real question then is like, yeah, what is it about them other than their success? Because the Messi Ronaldo example, there is something other than success that's at play here.
And so Foster Wallace's way of putting it is to describe Federer as a genius or mutant or avatar, never hurried or off balance. Movements are lithe rather than athletic. And what it is it's a paean to the beauty of sport. And he writes quite early on that beauty is not the goal of competitive sports.
Mm.
But high-level sports are a prime venue for the expression of human beauty, the relation being roughly that of courage to war. The human beauty is a kinetic beauty, and in men's sports, no one ever talks about beauty or grace of the body. Men may profess their love of sports, but that love must always be cast and enacted in the symbology of war.
Mm.
Elimination versus advance, hierarchy of rank and standing, obsessive statistics, technical analysis, tribal and or nationalistic fervor, uniforms, mass noise, banners, chest thumping, face painting, etc. For reasons that are not well understood, wars codes are safer for most of us than loves.
I think those reasons are understood and it's all about masculinity, but we're going to shelve that conversation for now. And
yeah, we can have that conversation another day.
Yeah.
But the point that Foster Wallace wants to make, right, is that there is a kind of beauty in this, an aesthetic to elite professional sports that absolutely does not exist at the Sunday afternoon soccer match.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting, right? And I think, again, I think it comes back to, I guess if you think about awe, and you think, because again, a lot of this comes back to awe and wonder for me, right? I think if we're talking about beauty, if we're talking about, even beauty in artistic pursuits, right? Let's just paint a broad brush here.
Mm.
I think the thing that I think defines beauty is something that inspires the feeling of awe. Mm. And the thing that I think defines the feeling of awe is something that happens in a way that you do not expect, in a way that is extremely pleasant.
Mm, interesting.
Right? No one is in awe of a horror film. Mm-hmm. Right, like you can be in awe of the cinematography or whatever else, but no one is like...
Not the film itself.
No one is in awe of a jump scare. No one is in awe of a, you know, no one is in awe of a random attack that happens on the street. Even so, it's not just about not expecting it. Mm-hmm. It's about the quality at which you are surprised by it.
The beauty of it.
Right, yeah. I think it's that the quality of the thing is more pleasant... Yeah, and again, it's going very Buddhist back to sensations, right? But like, yeah, more significantly more pleasant, or significantly more kind of eliciting of this kind of this positive emotion than you would expect it to be.
Which is why I find this such an interesting comparison, the Roger Federer as religious experience, because we've talked previously on the pod about what is a religion and the dividing line between religion and sport being somewhat hazy sometimes. But that tends to be because of all of the things that particularly team sport gives you, right? Like a sense of belonging and a tribalism and all of those kind of things, and a bunch of like-minded people doing the same thing, etc. And what he's talking about here is not that. And it's not about the belonging and having your tribe and your club, as much as Federer, Djokovic, Nadal ended up being that way.
Right.
But he's talking about the kind of the transcendence of the experience, and not just because you're invested in who wins or loses, but because you see that beauty, you're awestruck.
Yeah. Right, yeah. And I think it's that thing where it's like, you know, I think what's going on is Federer and Messi and whoever else you want to say are doing the thing in a way that seems so much more easy and graceful and, you know, just the impossible. And so, yeah, that it inspires a sense of awe. And I think absolutely anything that inspires a sense of awe can be a spiritual experience. Now, whether or not God is coming down and sending us Roger Federer in order to have that, I'm not, you know, I think there's maybe it's a different spiritual conversation there. But yeah,
I can come at Roger Federer being a gift from God. Sure, I think God gives many good things.
Everything's a gift from God to you, though.
Correct.
That's a cop out. When
everything's a gift, nothing is? Is that where you're going?
When everything's a gift has no meaning.
There's a whole other interesting conversation there about, like, yeah, anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think here's an interesting question. I don't know anything about this, but do you know anything about figure skating?
I've like watched it when the Winter Olympics are on. My knowledge of figure skating is up there with my knowledge of pretty much all other winter sports,
I guess figure
winter
skating
Olympics,
and gymnastics is maybe on the same ball here. Gymnastics this is a sport that is focused on beauty. Right, it's a sport where the competitive element of it is who is the most graceful, who is the most beautiful.
Yes, and diving would be a similar one as well, actually.
Right, yeah. So I think I'd be interested in, I mean, I don't think either of us know enough about it to go too far down this rabbit hole, but like, yeah, I think there's, you know, I think part of it is, again, it's the unexpected nature of it, right? Part of it is the fact that in tennis you don't expect that. In tennis you expect someone to hit a ball really hard and fast, and that's so hard and fast that someone else can't get to it.
Well, and this is the thing about Federer, right, is that it's not just the hard and fast, although a lot of this is Foster Wallace talking about the culture in tennis at that time and still now was you win by hitting the ball the hardest and the fastest, whereas Federer won by finding the half spaces and hitting the ball where nobody thought he was going to be able to hit it from a position that nobody thought he was going to be able, you know, the through the legs stuff and all of that, which was just insane, which is like it's like he's operating on a plane that nobody else is. And I don't mean that purely physically, but also he's got the secret to the Matrix.
Right.
At that moment, right?
Yeah. And so actually here's an interesting digression. And you know, this is a little bit egotistical, but I don't mean it in this way, but I think it's interesting. Like, you know, I've said before in this podcast, I play a competitive board game at a very high level.
Sure.
And you know, that's a board game that, you know, there's a certain kind of way of playing or whatever else. And I've had games that I have played before described as beautiful or inspiring, right? People have watched a series of moves that I've made that and kind of applied those terms to it. And certainly in the moment, I'm very much in a flow state that I don't feel like I don't feel in that moment, like I'm being called upon by any spiritual being. You know, I have a joke about the Jade Buddha, but it's a joke. It's sure. not, you know, it's a fun little bit that I think I, you know, it does kind of come into my play a bit, but it's not, you know, some insane, you know, thing that I'm actually drawing upon Buddhism. Like I am drawing upon Buddhism, but I'm not meditating whilst I'm doing it.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah. It's not a spiritual experience
right.
for you in that sense that it's giving you a closer experience of the divine, however you want to.
Right. And certainly there's not a correlation between the games where I do take a bit more time to focus on my spiritual practices beforehand and then the games that are then dubbed as beautiful games. Right. And so, you know, but I think it's quite interesting. It's an interesting, yeah, it's just an interesting thing to observe that
flow state is an interesting term to use, right? Because there's almost a spiritual aspect to flow state, right? Mm. Like to just the way that you're seeing things, and I mean, religious. We've talked about this meditation sometimes, right? That the grass seems just a little bit greener, and like everything seemed heightened, and flow state seems a bit like that, right? Like you just you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's that thing. It's it feels interesting reflecting on that and kind of going like, certainly as the actor in that scenario, I don't feel particularly spiritual. And I'm not at all claiming that anyone has had a spiritual experience watching me play Diplomacy, but I do like, but again, like I think there's an interesting thing of like, you know, to a lesser extent, there are people who look at that and go, oh, that's a beautiful thing, and but I don't observe the beauty when I'm in it.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's an aspect of that preaching can be somewhat similar to, actually, in that, like, because we're fallible human beings, you don't always feel amazing when you get up to preach. Sometimes you can feel nervous, sometimes you can feel tired, you know, whatever. But that doesn't make it less of a spiritual act. In a way, and I don't know, maybe that's uniquely Christian. I don't know whether there's an analog there to leading a meditation session or something like that.
I mean, I think that the difference with leading a meditation session is you're actually meditating in the meditation session at the same time.
Sure.
So, like, yeah, it's hard. You're probably doing a bad job if you're not at least somewhat engaging in a spiritual act.
Well, like, you're engaging in a spiritual act when you're preaching a sermon as well, right? Like, and quite consciously. But there's different degrees of how you feel about it in the moment, I guess.
I get that. Yeah.
And I can imagine you've put all this planning and welcomed people to the meditation retreat that it's harder to get into your meditation and let all the things go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Potentially. Yeah,
for sure. Have you ever had a spiritual experience watching sport?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. But I know there are people for whom sport, and this is more following sport than playing sport, seems to be their life in a way that's analogous to other people in religion. Like it's the thing that gives them meaning and purpose in what they're going about.
I have to say I've never fully understood that. It's not certainly not an approach that I take to life, but also like I've never know it's true. Like
no, you're familiar with the phenomenon. But it holds no appeal to you.
It holds no appeal, and it's I've also not understood it. Like I it feels somewhat incomprehensible to me that your football team doing well or not doing well is such a it is your life. Like that your life doing well or not doing well is measured off that fact. It doesn't.
I had a moment in 2020. When I realized from a close observance of my Facebook feed over that period that the thing that had been giving me the most joy was the relative success of my football team in England. and it wasn't that like I was heartbroken when they lost or anything like that. It was a particularly joyful season. It was Leeds 2020-21 finishing ninth under Marcelo Bielsa for anyone who's interested.
Right.
And it was just joyfully fun. Yeah, but my mood was surprisingly dependent on it.
Well, I think there's a difference between your mood being dependent. Like, again, like the point of it is you have fun and you engage with it. I totally get that. You know, I have that. I watch AFL and whether my
WWE.
Yes, whether my team does well or not, I can feel good or bad based. Yeah, I can watch a game and it can be objectively to a neutral observer an amazing game by the other team. But if my team have lost, I feel bad about that game and I don't like the game.
Of course.
Like, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
But like there's a difference between that and it being your life, between like, you know, your identity and who you are as a person, and like what you care the most about is this sports team. And like, I don't know, like,
but I mean, is that different to work or to, I mean, family's probably, family's a different thing.
Well, I mean, from a Buddhist perspective, nothing matters. Nothing's that relevant. But like,
from that perspective, right? Like, isn't it essentially arbitrary where you decide to get your joy if you're going to form what you would say an unhealthy attachment, and what I would say is idol worship? Like, if you're going to do that to something, does it really, like, as Alcoholics Anonymous say, like, just kind of, you just need a higher being, and that can be the cat down the street, or that can be the divine Lord Jesus Christ, savior of the universe, like, or it can be your football team, right?
I just had the Queen song Flash play through my head.
yeah.
Jesus, savior of the universe. Sorry. Complete tangent there.
Yeah.
But like, yes, no, I get that. I don't know. Like, I think the answer to that is yes, right? That like that I think both is true. Both, any of that is bad, and you should not have that unhealthy attachment to anything.
Duly noted about the Lord Jesus Christ.
Continue. Yes. Yep. But also, like, I don't know. Like, I think there is a difference between that being your friends and family and a football team, or even your work in a football team. And you know, I think.
So what is that difference?
Well, all right. I would say that there is it's a normative difference for one. I think, you know, culturally, one is more acceptable than the other. So like, there's a natural bias that I bring.
Sure, but just, if norms are
also a biased human being, and I bring in those norms, right?
Okay, sure.
But I would also say that it's about, I feel better about unhealthy attachments to things that are at least focused on the joy of others, or I think a combination, the joy of others, right? Focused on, I think if I'm unhealthily attached to my friends, yep, that is better because I am, you know, unhealthily attached to at least, you know, some kind of relational thing or something that is supporting others.
So you're making a value judgment.
Right, yeah, of course I'm making a value. Yeah, okay, yeah, cool. I'm aware of that.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm just interested in this because the ultimate perspective is like, well, what is good? What is bad?
We're taking that as a premise and then I'm making it.
Yeah, and you're being an inconsistent human being, yes, and that's absolutely fine because we all are.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But maybe the bigger one, though, is it's about volition, about what you can control, right? I can control my job to a certain extent. If I'm going to be unhealthily attached to something, I want it to be something that I have at least some control over.
Ride the roller coaster of the Carlton Football Club.
Right, yeah. I'm sorry, I don't mind the Carlton Football Club. I have 0% control over how successful or not successful the Carlton Football Club is.
Yeah, sure.
Like, maybe if I buy a membership and go to every game and shout at the top of my lungs in the stands right next to the players, I will have 0.00000001% of control over how well the Carlton Football Club does. But like, it's so abstract that I can find joy and misery in it, sure. But like, for that to be my life feels, I mean, that's kind of like, to me, that's kind of like saying, I really love the number six, and so my life is going to be completely dependent on whether or not I roll a dice and the number six comes up, right?
But like, people do this, right? Like, there's no level threes on apartments with Chinese backgrounds.
Yeah,
right?
But I think that's stupid.
Okay, fair enough.
Yes.
Consistently inconsistent.
Yeah,
I like it.
That sucks.
Yeah. Going back to kind of the beauty, the aesthetic of sport, there's a quote here that I absolutely love near the beginning of the article, is that the beauty we're talking about has nothing to do with sex or cultural norms. What it seems to have to do with, really, is human beings' reconciliation with the fact of having a body. And I wonder if that idea is something that you reckon is present in religions of varying degrees or not. There's this question of like, well, what does it mean to be an embodied human or not? Or what do we do about our bodies? It feels like sooner or later, every religious tradition has to reckon with that in some way, shape or form.
But Buddhism deals with it immediately.
Yeah, the body is an illusion, right?
Right, but also like that the fundamental unit of meditation is the breath, which is a bodily function.
Go on.
You know, and like, so, you know, there are 12 different potential units, objects of meditation in kind of the standard teachings. And the common one, the one you will get taught if you go to a meditation class, is the breath.
Yep.
But a huge part of Buddhism, in the one of the most immediate beginner teachings in Buddhism, is recognizing your body. Like learning to notice that you are a body and you are experiencing as a body and you are having this bodily experience. And that is the most basic of mindfulness in Buddhism.
Sure.
It's just observation of the body.
Yep.
And awareness of the body, and a kind of then developing a level of objectivity and indifference to the body. Right. Yeah. And there are Buddhist meditations around death where you imagine your body decaying. There are Buddhist meditations where before you eat, you eat your food and you have to imagine your food decaying and coming out the other side. And, you know, like there's all sorts of like, you know.
I wasn't aware of this. It's interesting.
Right.
Yeah. So have you done those?
Yeah.
Does it change the sensation of food?
No, I don't think it changes. It makes you certainly more aware of the sensation of the food.
Totally.
And certainly less like, ravenous, like, oh, I'm going to eat everything. And
like you appreciate the food, you savor it in a different way.
But I'm not like, I'm not savoring it as a, oh my God, this is so delicious, I'm kind of gluttonous about it, right?
Yeah. Well, there's an argument as to whether or not that's actually savoring it.
Right. Yeah. For sure. But yeah, so I think there's a whole bunch of stuff going on there. So yeah, in Buddhism, the body is a huge unit of observation, and it's a massive part of it. And yeah, I would say it is almost the first step on the Buddhist path, if you're thinking about a meditation or about a mindfulness practice, is again, and probably because it's the easier thing to do, right? It is much easier to observe the kind of the uncontrollability of your body than it is to do that with your mind.
Yes.
So the truth is still the same for your mind. You still need to observe your mind, and your mind is still completely uncontrollable and, you know, completely out, you know, subject to factors completely beyond you. But that's a harder thing to get your head around than my body is uncontrollable and subject to factors completely beyond me.
Yes, so, because I feel emotions. Right. Need to eat.
Right. And so, yeah. So the mindfulness of the body just becomes, it is the default in Buddhism.
Yeah.
Is there a Christian equivalent?
Not so much that mindfulness. There's definitely a Christian kind of reconciliation with the fact of having a body, which runs against probably Buddhism to an extent, but certainly other, you know, Greek traditions and so on, about the like a mind-soul distinction. Like there was this idea running around, you know, roughly at Jesus' time, that the body is dirty and flesh is. They actually had a whole physics, not just metaphysics, but physics around it, that the body was heavy and the soul was light, and lighter things were pure. So the stars must be really light because look how high up they are, right? And so
that's science, folks.
Correct. The first century style. So you've got this light soul that has, you know, a purity to it, but it's trapped in this fleshy, messy body. That's a Greek thinking at the time. And Christianity goes like, well, no, actually, because God created human beings as bodies. Like there's not something fundamentally in you that like you are wound up with the reality of your body. And so it's not something that you need to escape, but actually a gift from God. And, you know, famously, Gregory, I think of Nazianzus, I can never say his name properly, in about the 4th century, said that what is not assumed is not saved, which is basically, well, Jesus Christ came as a human being and died and was resurrected as a human being. And that's the dude had a body is a big deal in the resurrection accounts we have. Like he eats a bit of fish at some point, so they can see that they can't just see the bit of fish when he eats right? Because he's flesh and blood.
He has feet, so he's not a ghost.
Exactly right. Yes. Yeah. Good memory. Yeah. But so this whole idea is that it's the physical body is what God redeems, that God's not just, you know, the whole salvation, the Jesus' death and resurrection isn't just so that your soul can make an escape and do okay, but it's actually about the restoration of your full self, and you're an embodied self because that's how God's made you to be. So that's the Christian approach to it.
I mean, that makes sense, though, in a religion that very much focuses on an individual identity, right? An ego is very big and important in Christianity, right? Like you need to be yourself in order to be saved, right? Like, you know, you couldn't accept the premise that I am not Jacob because Jacob must be able to be saved.
Well, and also because, like, Jacob is specifically a, you know, dearly loved creation of God, right?
Right.
Like,
yeah, yeah.
It's not about the ego in the sense of, like, hey, look how good I am.
I mean, ego is an self-identity.
Yeah, sure. But it's a weird reconciliation of the two, that you find your self-identity fully when you're also fully found in God,
right,
along with everyone else. So there's a unity and an individuality that happens to it all at once. And if I try and make myself myself by myself, not in community with God and others, I actually wind up with a distorted, messed up view of who I am. Like, if my ego gets out of kilter.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Do you have any final thoughts on Roger Federer and on, you know, beauty and sport? And
I'm so glad you asked, because this has really helped me with something that I've wanted to frame for a while.
Okay.
Reading through this article, is that I reckon that there will be sport in eternity.
Okay.
Whatever that looks like. And I remember having a conversation with a friend about this years ago.
But who wins and loses?
Exactly, right. That's always been the question, is if the value of sport, if the joy we feel about sport really comes from the who wins and loses and whatever. But if the joy of sport is the beauty of seeing people do things, like inhabit their bodies really, really well, then I think there will be, and maybe we'll all just be phenomenally good at sport in eternity, or maybe we'll still have different gifts and talents in the same way we have different gifts and talents now. But I think that's the space that sport has in eternity, not in the caring about who wins and loses, but in the aesthetic, the beauty, the reconciliation of the body that happens there. So this has given me a helpful framework, I think. To think about that, because I like the idea of there being sport in eternity, and I also like the idea of not being caught up about who wins or loses and just being able to enjoy it as an art form. Really.
Yeah. I totally get that. Yeah. Nice. That actually reminds me of a time a Christian Buddhist walked into a bar.
Yeah, sports bar.
Sports bar.
Did you know that I was in the US in Alabama in 2016 on the day Donald Trump was elected president? And we watched the results in a sports bar. We asked them very nicely to turn off the NFL or whatever they were playing and put on the politics.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Well, in this sports bar, the Christian and Buddhist walk in and Roger Federer is there.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. Signing in autographs.
In a sports jacket.
You know, they're just generally having a beer, hanging out.
Yeah, nice.
You know, he's retired from tennis now, can hang out in bars.
Yeah.
So they go up to Roger Federer and they go, hey, Roger, we recorded a podcast about you. It's great. You know? and they got chatting and they were like, well, like, you know, so what was the secret to your success? Like, you know, you obviously one of the best tennis players ever. Like, you know, what was the secret here? And Roger was like, I consistent bedtime. You know, always went to bed at the same time every night. It was consistent. The sleep was really important. That made me a great player. And Christian, the Buddhist, was like, oh, like, can you tell us, like, what was your bedtime? And Roger was like, oh, it's obvious, right? It's tennis.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is a long way to go for that. if you want to hear more jokes like that and rambles like this, you can search Christian Buddhist Bar. Well, you found us already. Tell your friends. Get in touch, christianbuddhistbar@gmail.com.
That's right. And Kevin MacLeod does our music, and he is oh so beautiful in doing so.
It's a brilliant aesthetic, isn't it?
It really is, yes. Thank you very much, and we'll see you next week.
Ciao.